Good evening, or afternoon, I guess. One announcement is this for practice discussions. If you had a practice discussion today, you do not have one tomorrow. But if you had one yesterday, you have one tomorrow with the other teacher. If you met with me on Tuesday, tomorrow's Thursday, you'll meet with Brian. And we'll change the signs, that's what's posted, to make that clear. You'll meet at the same time, but different location. And then it'll be the same if you had a practice discussion today, not tomorrow, but the day after tomorrow, you'll have your second one on Friday. So I'd like to start my talk this afternoon with a quote, another quote from the suttas, from the early Buddhist scriptures. And this one involves water also. Last time I talked about building a raft and crossing the flood. But now here's another simile or something that uses water. Water is really powerful, and it's such a natural thing. And we can imagine in ancient India, they were connected to nature in a way that we aren't, in the sense that, you know, they didn't have some sophisticated buildings and concrete and the way that we do. Of course, they had buildings, but maybe not in the same ways that we do. So the quote goes like this. The Ganges River, maybe you guys know this is like a big river, right? The major river in India. The Ganges River slants, slopes, and inclines to the east. In the same way, a person developing and cultivating the five faculties, slants, slopes, and inclines to nibbana, to awakening, to freedom, peace, the ending of suffering. This idea of slanting, sloping, and inclining towards greater and greater freedom, greater and greater ease, awakening, ending of suffering, whatever expression is meaningful for you, makes sense for you at this time. So the Ganges River, slanting, sloping, and inclining. Something that I love about this quote is rivers only go one direction. They don't turn around and all of a sudden start going uphill or something like this. Right? We know this. We just kind of take it for granted that they're going downhill. Not only that, rivers have different characteristics in different places. There might be a place in which it's really steep and there's big waterfalls and there's a lot of energy and maybe frothing of the water. There might be times in which the river is really languid, maybe really wide and moving slowly, and maybe you're not even sure if is that really a river? Is it really moving? Or is that a lake? Or there might be times in which the river is like a little bit of an eddy, kind of going around. Water's moving, but it's maybe the dominant experience seems like it's going in circles. But we do know that the water finds its way down the hill. And not only this, rivers, they aren't like a straight line, nice, neat, and tidy, not touching anything else, but just going straight. No, rivers are like in contact with boulders, their banks, and they're like hitting these things and maybe splashing and then finding a way around or sometimes like over. So might be these obstructions, we might say, some of these boulders. But the river is just meeting whatever is in its path. So the Buddha is pointing to is in the same way that the rivers are going one direction, going downhill, having a different characteristics, different, whether it's fast or slow or seemingly going in circles. In the same way, the Buddha's teachings are going in the same direction. In the same way, our practice are pointing towards the same direction. The teachings are pointing and our practice is going in this direction. And it's when we hear something like this, we might think, oh, okay, so my practice should be something really linear, step one, two, three, and there I go. But anybody who's been on retreat for more than 45 minutes knows it's not neat and tidy, linear, step one, two, three. And the big picture, it is, but sometimes in the smaller picture, it doesn't feel that way. Sometimes in the smaller picture, we can't see where there might be some movement towards greater freedom and might feel like maybe we're jumping around or going backwards or just getting stuck here. But there's a way in which the more we practice, the more our practice is getting stronger. And maybe it's just drop by drop, moment by moment, but each moment of practice, each moment of mindfulness, and I'll expand this a little bit more. What does this mean by practice? Each moment is this helping us move towards greater freedom, greater ease, awakening, nibbana, peace, lessening of suffering, ending of suffering. So this quote is, "The Ganges River slants, slopes, and inclines to the east." In the same way, a person developing and cultivating the five faculties slants, slopes, and inclines to nibbana. Well, what does this mean to develop and cultivate the five faculties? What are the five faculties? And so, this idea of developing and cultivating, I think many of us have a sense of what that is. But one way in which we might describe it is the opposite of inertia. The opposite of absolutely nothing happening, that inertia not moving. But I don't know if humans have actual inertia. I mean, we feel like it. We feel like we don't have energy to move often. But there's a way in which, as long as our minds are working, as long as our hearts are working literally and figuratively, there is a movement of practice. But we might understand then inertia is not being engaged with what's happening. Inertia is not being connected to the experience of our environment, the experience inside. But maybe it's just maybe we could think of it as just going through the motions, a little bit on autopilot, not really aware or connected. And I know there certainly have been times in my life when I wanted to just be on autopilot. I didn't want to see and feel all that I was seeing and feeling, this really messy, difficult, exactly what I didn't want, being present. And I think this is a natural part of being human, of not wanting to be connected. But have you noticed that you can't be completely disconnected from absolutely everything always? There's a way in which life shows up and we do end up feeling something. We end up feeling connected or aware of things, whether we want to or not. So this opposite of inertia, this idea of developing and cultivating, right? Sometimes we're developing and cultivating avoidance, or developing and cultivating aversion. That's okay. This is what it means to be human. We learn about this, we learn, well, that maybe that doesn't work exactly the way I was hoping to in the long run. Maybe it helped for a short bit, but we can see in the bigger picture, this isn't going to be a strategy that's going to bring us the greatest happiness and ease in our lives. So the Buddha has another quote where he talks about what is this idea of developing and cultivating. And he says, when a person is grounded in one thing, the five faculties become developed. What is that one thing? Heedfulness. Appamada. Heedfulness. Sometimes appamada gets translated as heedfulness. This isn't a word that's often in my vocabulary. I don't use this word necessarily every day. So, like, what is heedfulness? We might say there's a whole maybe breadth of what this might mean. One is some diligence or some vigilance. This willingness to keep on coming back, some perseverance. But we might also understand heedfulness as this conscientiousness or attentiveness or maybe even bearing witness, some kind of way that Brian was talking about, you know, staying connected. Bearing witness is a way of stop being disconnected. So the heedfulness, paying attention, being present again and again, conscientiousness, some diligence, is a way in which we can cultivate and develop these five faculties. But there's one way in this whole idea of appamada, heedfulness, appamada. There's a way that we can use this idea of heedfulness, way of being engaged as best we can. Let's be honest, sometimes we can't completely be engaged or connected. That's part of the human experience too. But as best we can, we can use this as a way to maybe assess our practice, as opposed to some of the other usual ways that we might. But this idea that if our practice is sincere, we're doing the best we can, and the wide range that shows up, and the way that we're engaged, and we have this maybe a sense of encouragement inside of us, like this is the direction I want to go. even if it's a vague, subtle sense that we have in our minds, then we don't need to know exactly where we are in our path of practice or how much progress we've made or anything like this. Instead, we can use this idea that, okay, things slant, slope, and incline towards Nibbana if we're engaged as best we can, if we're bringing some type of sincerity to practice, as opposed to sometimes measuring ourselves. This is, I find myself saying this often, this is what humans do, measure ourselves, but sometimes with the measurement comes a lot of, yeah, but there was that time you were different and you shouldn't be like this again, or there's that person over there who's doing this, or, well, at least you're not like that other person over there. And, you know, it always ends up with kind of this not as necessarily a good feeling. So apamada is a way that we can use this measurement of, are we engaged as best we can? Is there a certain amount of sincerity in our practice? And I do want to say that we should never like measure or have a sense of how our practice is going. A, because humans are going to do this anyway. And B, maybe there is helpful sometimes to acknowledge that where we are in practice, because maybe then we can open to that phase a little bit more fully. Seems like a little bit more contentment is arising. I see this in a corner of my experience, some more contentment. And I know or have this sense that contentment is on the way towards greater ease and freedom. Maybe I can open to this contentment, allow for it, appreciate it, value it. So in some ways, there can be a place to have a sense of where we are in practice. But I think we all know this. We want to be patient with our practice. I don't know how it is for you, but for me, it's never on the timeline I wish it were. And the practice unfolds, and the way that it unfolds, it's slanting, sloping, and inclining towards greater freedom, as long as we are engaged and heedful apamada. So this quote was, cultivating and developing the five faculties, slants, slopes, and inclines towards Nibbana. Well, what are these five faculties? Some of you will be familiar with this. Some of you know this. Some of you maybe not. That's okay. I'll talk about them a little bit here. First, I'm just going to list them. The five faculties. Would you be surprised if I said there are five of them? And first is faith, sadha, or sada, sometimes pronounced. Faith, or sometimes we use the word confidence to translate that word. Energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So the five faculties, there's a whole chapter in this, one of the books of the early scriptures or suttas. That's a big chapter that's so many different tiny little suttas. They're all about the five faculties, different ways to look at them, talk about them, work with them. And here's one that I find useful and helpful, and it talks about elephants. And when we think about, well, we know that elephants are rather large animals. I don't know if there's any larger land animals. In my mind, elephants are the largest, but I'm not an expert on these things. But we can imagine in ancient India, thousands of years ago, elephants are not only really large, they're really powerful. They have strength that no other beings have, right? If we think before motors or, you know, any of this kind of stuff, probably elephants were the most powerful thing that they knew about, other than lightning or something like this. Monsoon and floods, maybe. So here's a simile that the Buddha is giving that references elephants. Just as the footprints of all living beings that walk, the footprints of humans, footprints of tigers, just as the footprints of all living beings that walk fit into the footprint of the elephant, and the elephant's footprint is declared to be their chief by reason of its size. I did Google this, the size of an elephant's footprint, and I forgot the answer now that I'm sitting here, but I remember my going like, wow. So it's a footprint that makes a person go, wow. So big footprints, the biggest of any land creature that they knew about. So the Buddha continues, so too, among the steps that lead to awakening, the faculty of wisdom is declared to be their chief for the attainment of awakening. And what are these steps that lead to awakening? The faculty of faith is a step that leads to awakening. The faculty of energy is a step that leads to awakening. The faculty of mindfulness is a step that leads to awakening. The faculty of concentration is a step that leads to awakening. The faculty of wisdom is a step that leads to awakening. So the Buddha is taking these five faculties and saying these are all steps that lead to awakening, and the chief, the biggest, the most important is wisdom. And in this tradition, wisdom is seen as the gateway to awakening, to liberation, to more peace, more freedom, less suffering, ending of suffering. So what is wisdom? Wisdom is a faculty we all have. The Buddha isn't saying create something out of nothing. He's saying to develop and cultivate something we already have. And so it tends to, and sometimes when we hear this word wisdom, sometimes there might be this association with knowing a lot. And sometimes a sense of book learning, or maybe knowing all the suttas, or knowing Pali, or something like this. And it's not about that. It's not about knowing a lot. It's about developing our natural capacity to see clearly. Wisdom is about our natural capacity to see clearly, and in particular to see, oh, this is helpful, this is not helpful in supporting greater freedom, greater ease. So we might say wisdom is having some discernment, some ability to tell the difference. Oh, this leads towards greater freedom. This might slant, slope, and incline to freedom. This doesn't. And it's so important to know both of these, right? Which doesn't and which does. And sometimes, right, we learn what doesn't by trying things and realizing, oh, that didn't work. I feel awful. I feel worse now. And even though this might be a habit we have, this might be a lot of momentum, we might discover, and you know, this, I'm hoping there's another way because this isn't working. And so wisdom is to be able to even be able to see, oh, this isn't working. But I think that there might be something else over here, something different that is working. So this natural capacity to see clearly what's helpful and what isn't helpful. But helpful in bringing more freedom. Not helpful in getting what we want. Because that is always wanting to get what we want is a way in which we're being pushed around by what we want, because we're always chasing it or trying to avoid something, and that's actually not freedom. If we only have a sense of ease when we got something that we wanted, that's not freedom. Freedom is being okay even when you don't get what you want, and that being okay too. That's real freedom. And that's what I wish for all of you. That even when you're not getting what you want, because let's face it, life has a lot of not what we want. But can we be okay? Can we be okay? Can we be okay with that? Not with that, despite that. So this development of wisdom, this cultivation of wisdom, we might think about this. Well, what does this mean? It's about this seeing clearly, this is helpful, this isn't helpful, towards more freedom. But what is this idea of cultivating or developing wisdom? And we might say that this development of wisdom allows a different type of seeing. It's different than having figured it out. It's different than probing deeply. Sometimes we do like these kind of interior archaeological digs, and there is value there, but that's having a greater understanding. But the wisdom that I'm pointing to is a way in which things are maybe revealed, or things are, maybe there's a way in which they're realized. It's a type of knowing that is maybe more felt, like, oh yeah, this is true. And we can have these types of realization or discovery, or that's different than using the mind to figure it out. And I don't want to say that we never need to figure things out. That's a really powerful and useful capacity. But I'm pointing to something a little bit different, than in a way in which we are allowing experience to show its nature to us. So we're creating the conditions in which things can be seen. The quality of them can be seen. The characteristics of them can be seen. And so what are we seeing with this wisdom? Part of what we're seeing are the building blocks of our experience. The building blocks through which we are building the conventional world that we live in. For example, some of these building blocks, or I'm not sure that language is the right one, but in some way, what we're seeing is that, well, everything arises from something else. Of course it does. I mean, right, it sounds a little bit silly maybe even to say that, but maybe we don't think about that so thoroughly with everything. Like, there are no exceptions. Everything in this conventional world that we're creating is built from something else. If it's raining, there are clouds. So if the clouds go away, there isn't rain. Seems kind of simple, but there's a way in which maybe we don't appreciate, or maybe, see clearly that if the conditions aren't there, then something ceases to exist. Maybe in the same way in which there is suffering, well, what is it that's supporting the suffering? What are the conditions? Clinging, grasping, holding tightly. And when this clinging, this grasping, this holding tightly softens, stops, that suffering stops. So we can ask ourselves, when we're encountering suffering, what's being held on to? What am I clinging to? What is being grasped? For example, if we're like feeling displeased or irritated, or with seemingly everything, is there something that we're holding on to? Maybe there's a belief that everything has to match my preferences in order for it to be okay, in order for me to be okay. I can't be okay unless all my preferences are being matched. I remember somebody, a teacher, saying to me, like, and how's that going? Well, it's not going so well. I'm trying to manufacture, manipulate, engineer, trying to get everything to match my preferences, and the world is not cooperating. Right? Or maybe we have this belief that if I feel uncomfortable, then something is horribly wrong, and there must be somebody or something to blame about it. Instead of, oh, okay, there's uncomfortableness here. Can I bear witness to it? Can I hold it? I'm uncomfortable. I don't want to be uncomfortable. How does that feel? I don't want to feel the uncomfortableness of being uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable with that. Okay, how does that uncomfortableness feel? So this recognition that there's conditions that are underlying everything. And so maybe we can influence some of those conditions and make it more likely that certain other things will happen. And one way that I started to like play around with this is I had this idea that, well, I should go out for a walk or a run like much more often. So maybe if I put some of the conditions in place, make it more likely that this will actually happen. And as it happened at that time, and I still do, I had these socks that I really loved. They were like really comfy, and I don't know, I just got a kick out of that one of them had an L and one of them had an R. And I just thought, this is really cute. And I don't know, I just liked it somehow. So I got more than one pair of these socks, and I made sure that I always had a clean pair of these socks, and I would put them near my running shoes near the door. And there was just something about, oh, I'm going to put these socks on. And okay, well, while I have these socks on, I might as well put my shoes on. But now that I have my shoes on, okay, I guess I'll go outside, go for a walk or run or whatever it might be. But just creating the conditions in which it would more likely that I would be doing something that was going to be helpful for my life. So this works both ways, that if something was we're being experienced right now, we can have this gentle inquiry. What are some of the conditions in place that are supporting it? If there's suffering in particular, and the Buddhist teachings, and I think probably all of us have recognized there's a certain type of clinging or really holding on tightly, and we may not be clear what we're holding tightly to. But maybe we can feel this. You know, I'm going like this with my body because it often feels like this. Like, dang it, things should not be this way. And that's not to say that the way everything is perfect and nothing ever needs to change. I don't want to say that at all. But just this recognition that everything arises from something else. This is part of wisdom, is to be able to see this in a maybe a deep way, maybe even a radical way, and that we can use this when there's suffering. What is some of the, what's underlying that? What are some of the conditions that are supporting it? If I want freedom, what are some of the conditions that are going to support that? And can I influence or help put in place some of those conditions? Or maybe there's this seeing, wisdom is also helping to see in some radical way the changing, impermanent, inconstant nature of all of our experiences and this world that we live in, that nothing is staying the same, really. And there's this, not only like on the big time scale, but on really small time scales too, right? That our thoughts aren't exactly the same, even though we might feel like we're like stuck in this maybe compulsive or way in which we're going round and around with something, but they're not exactly the same often. Well, yeah. Or seeing in some radical way that all the ideas and concepts that we live by are just that. They're ideas and concepts. They're thoughts. Thoughts? How many thoughts have you had today? They're ephemeral. They're coming and going. They're changing. They're not tangible. There's something that... they are thoughts. They arise and pass away. So these ideas and concepts aren't as solid, aren't as steady as we often think they are. And often we want to hold on to them, but they turn out not to be such a great life preserver, something to hold on to. Or maybe we start to see in a deep way some of the, just this general unsatisfactoriness, the stressfulness, this things not being quite right, that is so like prevalent with all our all of our experiences, the dukkha. So there's a way in which seeing these things, the conditioned nature, they're always changing. There's this unsatisfactoriness to them. There's just a natural letting go that happens. If clinging is suffering, if this clinging is underlying the suffering, this radical seeing allows just this letting go to happen, because it just doesn't make sense to hold on to things that are only there intermittently and we can't count on them, or everything turns out not to be quite as satisfying as we thought it were going to be. It's not a lasting source of happiness. Maybe there was a flicker of some happiness, but there isn't this lasting sense of happiness associated with it. So this letting go just naturally happens. Just feels like, oh, I thought this holding on was going to make things better, but it actually turns out not to. Maybe this is not even really a thought. It's just letting go is happening. And if this letting go has been deep enough, then some of our attachments might come back. There might be some of this clinging, holding on again. But now things are different. Because there's, now that we have tasted or sensed that there's this type of letting go that is possible, then there's our relationship to clinging starts to shift. We start to see, oh, this clinging is not so desirable. This clinging turns out not to be giving me the results that I was hoping it was going to. And I know that there's something better. It doesn't mean that we can always access it again. It doesn't mean that we should be striving to have that sense of letting go again. But practice is so much about shifting our relationship to what's happening, as opposed to making what's happening being really perfect. So this wisdom helps us to have this deep seeing. And some of this deep seeing is to some of the underlying conditions of all of our experiences. It's conditioned. Turns out not to have a stable core. It's always changing and has this unsatisfactory quality. And with that wisdom, this deep seeing, there's this letting go. And with this letting go, there's greater freedom. That slants, slopes, and inclines to even more freedom. So these five faculties, and the chief among them is wisdom. But the Buddha also talked about how each of these faculties is a step to awakening. So what about these other ones? What about these other four? So these the list of the five faculties, one way we might understand it is it's in a very particular order. And I'll say this, every single time it shows up in the suttas is in precisely the same order. It begins with faith, confidence. I myself appreciate this very much. Faith is the starting point. It is not the ending point. It starts with, okay, this practice seems reasonable. I'm going to give it a try. Seems reasonable. Maybe we read a book that made sense. Maybe we know somebody who does it that said it would be good, or try it. Or maybe we don't have a lot of direct experience. We give it a try. And then we get some results. Maybe we do the experiment and we have some results and say, okay, it seems to give some support for our life. For if you're like me in the beginning, I'm like, okay, I'm not so sure about this whole Buddhism thing, but this practice seems to help, seems to make my life better. Some of the teachings, I'm like, I don't get it, but whatever. The teacher seems like a nice person, so. But then this grows into confidence, right, when we have more experiences. And then we might ask, well, how does this confidence, how does this faith, how can this be developed so that it supports wisdom? Which supports seeing, which supports letting go, which supports freedom. And we might say that this faith, this confidence grows in a way in which we learn to trust the practice. Trust the practice. And then we have the second faculty, which is energy or effort, gets translated either ways. And I think all of us know this, that there's no practice with a little bit of effort. I talked about engagement, upadana, upamada. And it takes effort. It takes effort to get to the cushion, to come to the meditation hall, to be doing this practice, or when you really don't want to. And then part of the art of practice is learning, well, okay, how do I have effort that's not too strained and striving and stressful, but not completely complacent either? And this is something, this is the art of practice that we are always working with. Sometimes heroic effort feels like it's needed. I'll say for me that there was a time I had so much fear. I couldn't even tell you what I was afraid of. I was afraid of everything. I just had so much fear. And my practice discussions with the teachers was about fear. And I just felt so ill at ease. And I couldn't like point my finger on what it was. And but I still had this idea that I wanted to practice, even though it was so uncomfortable, all this fear, and I would much prefer to just be busy doing something in my daily life. And I couldn't quite find a way that I could hold this or be with this fear until, I don't know, this is a little bit embarrassing to share, but I will share that I had this stuffed animal, Mr. Bearby, I called him. That somebody had given me, now I don't remember the occasion, but it was during my adult life that somebody had given me this little stuffed teddy bear, and it was like wearing sheep's clothing, and it was, I don't know, it was just really cute. And right, I'm smiling now because I would just like smile when I saw this thing, and so I thought, okay, Mr. Bearby, you're going on retreat with me. I brought Mr. Bearby. He fit in my suitcase, so he came with me. And I don't know, somehow it was just helpful. This is kind of what I needed, to have this little bit of support that could bring a little bit of the courage to meet whatever needed to be met. I still have Mr. Bearby. He doesn't go on retreat with me so much now. Maybe he should. Maybe he misses it. I don't know. But so just this recognition that, you know, sometimes it is feel like heroic effort and a lot of courage. But, you know, sometimes there is this effort is easy and delightful too. Maybe there's wide range. But maybe we can talk about, well, how can this effort be developed so that it supports wisdom, this liberating wisdom, so that it supports letting go? And maybe an answer to that question is, maybe there's a delicate diligence or a relaxed persistence or a commitment that's easeful. It's one way we might understand the energy or effort. So then mindfulness, we've been practicing mindfulness, and it begins with our just showing up and to the present moment as best we can, again and again and again and again and again, moment by moment, drop by drop. This way of letting go of our preoccupations and the way that just allowing this mindfulness to develop and we're able to sustain our attention a little bit longer, a little bit longer, allowing some of the momentum of mindfulness to build. So that we're able to, using Brian's expression, to bear witness to our experience. Maybe to not to be so lost in it, but to be able to observe what's happening and in a way that doesn't have this judging or doesn't have this way in which we are necessarily interfering, but bearing witness. So we can ask ourselves, well, how can this mindfulness be cultivated and developed so that it supports wisdom, that supports clear seeing, that supports letting go, that supports freedom? And maybe the answer to that question might be that the mindfulness that we start to observe, we start to see that phenomena are coming and going, maybe more than we're realizing. That there's this inconstancy and that we have been projecting a constancy onto them. But with mindfulness, we're seeing, oh yeah, there's a lot of coming and going happening, arising and passing, starting and ending, happening. And then the fourth faculty, concentration, samadhi. We might think of samadhi as a way of being non-distracted or this way of being collected or settled with a sense of well-being. This is one of the characteristics of samadhi, is a certain unification, collection with a state of well-being. And so it's maybe a gathering together or bringing together. Or so it's sometimes we hear this word concentration, which is why I like the word samadhi better. But when we hear that word, sometimes we think we have to strain and have this focus, and my shoulders go up when I do this because this often this tightness that feels like, oh, I got to get concentrated. But instead, it's this gathering, maybe this collectedness, this coming together with this sense of well-being. Because this might include the gathering together of the disparate parts of who we are. There's a way in which we might be living a life that's fragmented and it's a little bit over here and we're still stinging from that thing that happened yesterday and we're trying to get settled here and remember when our practice discussions are and what am I going to say to the teacher and all these different things. But with samadhi, with this practice, rather than being in conflict with what's happening in this practice, is we just include it. Yep, this too. This too can be brought into the practice. This too. Whatever it might be. So then we can ask ourselves, well, how can this concentration be developed so that it supports liberating wisdom and letting go? And maybe this collectedness, this, which allows for some steadiness, maybe the steadiness that allows for some of this clear seeing that I've been talking about with wisdom, this seeing some of the changing nature and seeing that ideas and concepts are just ideas and concepts. In the same way that a tripod helps a telescope see better, see more clearly. In the same way, samadhi, bringing some steadiness, can help see things more clearly. So this expression that the Buddha is saying, in the same way that the Ganges River slants, slopes, and inclines to the east, in the same way the cultivating and developing of the five faculties slants, slopes, and inclines towards greater freedom. There's lots of different ways to practice with the five faculties. I talked about one way, is pointing out how wisdom is the chief, and we can use the other four as a guidance for cultivating and developing them. Are they supporting wisdom? And then for the next hour of my talk, I'll talk about all the other ones. Don't worry, I'm not going to have you guys sit here for another hour, but I just want to say that this is one way to work with the five faculties, but it's a way in which we might have maybe a North Star, a direction we're going, something that our practice is pointing towards. Greater freedom, greater wisdom, which we're understanding as seeing this is helpful and this is not so helpful, or seeing some of the what's underneath, or what are some of the building blocks of our experiences. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Developing and cultivating these slants, slopes, and inclines towards greater freedom, towards Nibbana. So let's just sit for a few moments. You don't have to change your posture if you don't want to. Thank you for your practice and for your kind attention.